No one can imagine every feature and consequence of a future event, hence we must consider some and fail to consider others. The problem is that the features and consequences we fail to consider are often quite important. You may recall the study in which college students were asked to imagine how they would feel a few days after their school's football team played a game against its arch rival. The results showed that students overestimated the duration of the game's emotional impact because when they tried to imagine their future experience, they imagined their team winning. The clock will hit zero, we'll storm the field, everyone will cheer, but failed to imagine what they would be doing afterward. And then I'll go home and study for my final exams. Because the students were focused on the game, they failed to imagine how events that happened after the game would influence their happiness. So what should they have done instead? They should have abandoned imagination altogether. Consider a study that put people in a similar predicament and then forced them to abandon their imaginations. In this study, a group of volunteers, whom I will call the reporters, first received a delicious prize, a gift certificate from a local ice cream parlor, and then performed a long, boring task in which they counted and recorded geometric shapes that appeared on a computer screen. Next, a new group of volunteers was told that they would also receive a prize and do the same boring task. Some of these new volunteers, whom I'll call simulators, were told what the prize was and were asked to use their imaginations to predict their future feelings. Other volunteers, whom I'll call surrogators, were not told what the prize was, but were instead shown the report of a randomly selected reporter. Not knowing what the prize was, they couldn't possibly use their imaginations to predict their future feelings. Instead, they had to rely on the reporter's report. Once all the volunteers had made their predictions, they received the prize, did the long, boring task, and reported how they actually felt. The results showed that simulators weren't as happy as they thought they'd be. Why? Because they failed to imagine how quickly the joy of receiving a gift certificate would fade when it was followed by a long, boring task. This is precisely the same mistake that the college football fans made. Although simulators made inaccurate predictions of their future happiness, surrogators made extremely accurate predictions of their future happiness. These surrogators didn't know what kind of prize they would receive, but they did know that someone who had received that prize had been less than ecstatic at the conclusion of the boring task. So they shrugged and reasoned that they too would feel less than ecstatic at the conclusion of the boring task, and they were right. Imagination's second shortcoming is its tendency to project the present onto the future, which we explored in the section on presentism. When imagination paints a picture of the future, many of the details are necessarily missing, and imagination solves this problem by filling in the gaps with details that it borrows from the present. Anyone who's ever shopped on an empty stomach, vowed to quit smoking after stubbing out a cigarette, or proposed marriage while on shore leave knows that how we feel now can erroneously influence how we think we'll feel later. As it turns out, surrogation can remedy this shortcoming too. In one study, reporters ate a few potato chips and reported how much they enjoyed them. Next, a new group of volunteers was fed pretzels, peanut butter cheese crackers, tortilla chips, breadsticks, and Melba toast, which, as you might guess, left them thoroughly stuffed and with little desire for salty snack foods. These stuffed volunteers were then asked to predict how much they would enjoy eating a particular food the next day. Some of these stuffed volunteers were simulators who were told that the food they would eat the next day was potato chips, and they were asked to use their imaginations to predict how they would feel after eating them. Other stuffed volunteers were surrogators who were not told what the next day's food would be, but were instead shown the report of one randomly selected reporter. Because surrogators didn't know what the next day's food would be, they couldn't use their imaginations to predict their future enjoyment of it, and thus they had to rely on the reporter's report. Once all the volunteers had made their predictions, they went away, returned the next day, ate some potato chips, and reported how much they enjoyed them. The results revealed that simulators enjoyed eating potato chips more than they thought they would. Why? Because when they made their predictions, they had bellies full of pretzels and crackers. But surrogators, who were equally full when they made their predictions, relied on the report of someone without a full belly and hence made much more accurate predictions. It's important to note that the surrogators accurately predicted their future enjoyment of a food, despite the fact that they didn't even know what the food was. Imagination's third shortcoming is its failure to recognize that things will look different once they happen. In particular, that bad things will look a whole lot better, which we explored in the section on rationalization. When we imagine losing a job, for instance, we imagine the painful experience without also imagining how our psychological immune systems will transform its meaning. Can surrogation remedy this shortcoming? To find out, researchers arranged for some people to have an unpleasant experience. A group of reporters was told that the experimenter would flip a coin, and if it came up heads, the reporter would receive a gift certificate to a local pizza parlor. The coin was flipped, and oh, so sorry, it came up tails, and the reporters received nothing. The reporters then reported how they felt. Next, a new group of volunteers was told about the coin flipping game and was asked to predict how they would feel if the coin came up tails and they didn't get the pizza gift certificate. Some of these volunteers were simulators, and they were told the precise monetary value of the gift certificate. And others were surrogators who were instead shown the report of one randomly selected reporter. Once the volunteers had made their predictions, the coin was flipped and, oh, so sorry, came up tails. The volunteers then reported how they felt. The results of this study showed that simulators felt better than they predicted they'd feel if they lost the coin flip. Why? Because simulators did not realize how quickly and easily they would rationalize the loss. Pizza's too fattening, and besides, I don't like that restaurant anyway. But surrogators, who had nothing to go on except the report of another randomly selected individual, assumed that they wouldn't feel too bad after losing the prize, hence made more accurate predictions. Rejecting the solution. This trio of studies suggests that when people are deprived of the information that imagination requires, and are thus forced to use others as surrogates, they make remarkably accurate predictions about their future feelings, which suggests that the best way to predict our feelings tomorrow is to see how others are feeling today. Given the impressive power of this simple technique, we should expect people to go out of their way to use it, but they don't. When an entirely new group of volunteers was told about the three situations I just described, winning a prize, eating a mystery food, or failing to receive a gift certificate, and was then asked whether they would prefer to make predictions about their future feelings based on A, information about the prize, the food, and their certificate, or B, information about how a randomly selected individual felt after winning them, eating them, or losing them, virtually every volunteer chose the former. If you hadn't seen the results of these studies, you'd probably have done the same. If I offered to pay for your dinner at a restaurant if you could accurately predict how much you were going to enjoy it, would you want to see the restaurant's menu or some randomly selected diner's review? If you're like most people, you'd prefer to see the menu, and if you're like most people, you'd end up buying your own dinner. Why? Because if you're like most people, then like most people, you don't know you're like most people. Science has given us a lot of facts about the average person, and one of the most reliable of these facts is that the average person doesn't see herself as average. Most students see themselves as more intelligent than the average student. Most business managers see themselves as more competent than the average business manager, and most football players see themselves as having better football sense than their teammates. 90% of motorists consider themselves to be safer than average drivers, and 94% of college professors consider themselves to be better than average teachers. Ironically, the bias towards seeing ourselves as better than average causes us to see ourselves as less biased than average, too. As one research team concluded, quote, "Most of us appear to believe that we are more athletic, intelligent, organized, ethical, logical, interesting, fair-minded, and healthy, not to mention more attractive, than the average person." This tendency to think of ourselves as better than others is not necessarily a manifestation of our unfettered narcissism, but may instead be an instance of a more general tendency to think of ourselves as different from others, often for the better, but sometimes for the worse. When people are asked about generosity, they claim to perform a greater number of generous acts than others do, but when they're asked about selfishness, they claim to perform a greater number of selfish acts than others do. When people are asked about their ability to perform an easy task, such as driving a car or riding a bike, they rate themselves as better than others. But when they're asked about their ability to perform a difficult task, such as juggling or playing chess, they rate themselves as worse than others. We don't always see ourselves as superior, but we almost always see ourselves as unique. Even when we do precisely what others do, we tend to think that we're doing it for unique reasons. For instance, we tend to attribute other people's choices to features of the chooser. Phil picked this class because he's one of those literary types. but we tend to attribute our own choices to features of the options. I picked this class because it was easier than economics. We recognize that our decisions are influenced by social norms. I was too embarrassed to raise my hand in class even though I was terribly confused, but we fail to recognize that others' decisions were similarly influenced. No one else raised a hand because no one else was as confused as I was. We know that our choices sometimes reflect our aversions. I voted for Kerry because I couldn't stand Bush. But we assume that other people's choices reflect their appetites. If Rebecca voted for Kerry, then she must have liked him. The list of differences is long, but the conclusion to be drawn from it is short. The self considers itself to be a very special person. What makes us think we're so darn special? Three things, at least. First, even if we aren't special, the way we know ourselves is. We are the only people in the world whom we can know from the inside. We experience our own thoughts and feelings, but must infer that other people are experiencing theirs. We all trust that behind those eyes and inside those skulls, our friends and neighbors are having subjective experiences very much like our own, but that trust is an article of faith and not the palpable, self-evident truth that our own subjective experiences constitute. There's a difference between making love and reading about it, and it's the same difference that distinguishes our knowledge of our own mental lives from our knowledge of everyone else's. Because we know ourselves and others by such different means, we gather very different kinds and amounts of information. In every waking moment, we monitor the steady stream of thoughts and feelings that runs through our heads, but we only monitor other people's words and deeds, and only when they're in our company. One reason why we seem so special, then, is that we learn about ourselves in such a special way. The second reason is that we enjoy thinking of ourselves as special. Most of us want to fit in well with our peers, but we don't want to fit in too well. We prize our unique identities, and research shows that when people are made to feel too similar to others, their moods quickly sour, and they try to distance and distinguish themselves in a variety of ways. If you've ever shown up at a party and found someone else wearing exactly the same dress or necktie that you were wearing, then you know how unsettling it is to share the room with an unwanted twin whose presence temporarily diminishes your sense of individuality. Because we value our uniqueness, it isn't surprising that we tend to overestimate it. The third reason why we tend to overestimate our uniqueness is that we tend to overestimate everyone's uniqueness. That is, we tend to think of people as more different from one another than they actually are. Let's face it, all people are similar in some ways and different in others. The psychologists, biologists, economists, and sociologists who are searching for universal laws of human behavior naturally care about the similarities, but the rest of us care mainly about the differences. Social life involves selecting particular individuals to be our sexual partners, business partners, bowling partners, and more. That task requires that we focus on the things that distinguish one person from another and not on the things that all people share, which is why personal ads are much more likely to mention the advertiser's love of ballet than his love of oxygen. A penchant for respiration explains a great deal about human behavior. For example, why people live on land, become ill at high altitudes, have lungs, resist suffocation, love trees, and so on. It surely explains more than does a person's penchant for ballet. But it does nothing to distinguish one person from another, and thus for ordinary folks who are in the ordinary business of selecting others for commerce, conversation, or copulation, the penchant for air is stunningly irrelevant. Individual similarities are vast, but we don't care much about them because they don't help us do what we're here on Earth to do, namely distinguish Jack from Jill and Jill from Jennifer. As such, these individual similarities are an inconspicuous backdrop against which a small number of relatively minor individual differences stand out in bold relief. Because we spend so much time searching for, attending to, thinking about, and remembering these differences, we tend to overestimate their magnitude and frequency, and thus end up thinking of people as more varied than they actually are. If you spent all day sorting grapes into different shapes, colors, and kinds, you'd become one of those annoying grapophiles who talks endlessly about the nuances of flavor and the permutations of texture. You'd come to think of grapes as infinitely varied, and you'd forget that almost all of the really important information about a grape can be deduced from the simple fact of its grapehood. Our belief in the variability of others and in the uniqueness of the self is especially powerful when it comes to emotion. Because we can feel our own emotions but must infer the emotions of others by watching their faces and listening to their voices, we often have the impression that others don't experience the same intensity of emotion that we do, which is why we expect others to recognize our feelings even when we can't recognize theirs. This sense of emotional uniqueness starts early. When kindergartners are asked how they and others would feel in a variety of situations, they expect to experience unique emotions and they provide unique reasons for experiencing them. When adults make these same kinds of predictions, they do just the same thing. Our mythical belief in the variability and uniqueness of individuals is the main reason why we refuse to use others as surrogates. After all, surrogation is only useful when we can count on a surrogate to react to an event roughly as we would. And if we believe that people's emotional reactions are more varied than they actually are, then surrogation will seem less useful to us than it actually is. The irony, of course, is that surrogation is a cheap and effective way to predict one's future emotions. But because we don't realize just how similar we all are, we reject this reliable method and rely instead on our imaginations, as flawed and fallible as they may be. Onward. Despite its watery connotation, the word hogwash refers to the feeding and not to the bathing of pigs. Hogwash is something that pigs eat, that pigs like, and that pigs need. Farmers provide pigs with hogwash because without it, pigs get grumpy. The word hogwash also refers to the falsehoods people tell one another. Like the hogwash that farmers feed their pigs, the hogwash that our friends and teachers and parents feed us is meant to make us happy. But unlike hogwash of the porcine variety, human hogwash doesn't always achieve its end. As we've seen, ideas can flourish if they preserve the social systems that allow them to be transmitted. Because individuals don't usually feel that it's their personal duty to preserve social systems, these ideas must disguise themselves as a prescription for individual happiness. We might expect that after spending some time in the world, our experiences would debunk these ideas, but it doesn't always work that way. To learn from our experience, we must remember it. And for a variety of reasons, memory is a faithless friend. Practice and coaching get us out of our diapers and into our britches, but they're not enough to get us out of our presence and into our futures. What's so ironic about this predicament is that the information we need to make accurate predictions of our emotional futures is right under our noses, but we don't seem to recognize its aroma. It doesn't always make sense to heed what people tell us when they communicate their beliefs about happiness, but it does make sense to observe how happy they are in different circumstances. Alas, we think of ourselves as unique entities, minds unlike any others, and thus we often reject the lessons that the emotional experience of others has to teach us. Afterword. My mind presageth happy gain and conquest. Shakespeare, King Henry VI, Part 3. Most of us make at least three important decisions in our lives: where to live, what to do, and with whom to do it. We choose our towns and our neighborhoods. We choose our jobs and our hobbies. We choose our spouses and our friends. Making these decisions is such a natural part of adulthood that it's easy to forget that we're among the first human beings to make them. For most of recorded history, people lived where they were born, did what their parents had done, and associated with those who were doing the same. Millers milled, Smiths smithed, and little Smiths and little Millers married whom and when they were told. Social structures, such as religions and castes, and physical structures, such as mountains and oceans, were the great dictators that determined how, where, and with whom people would spend their lives, which left most folks with little to decide for themselves. But the agricultural, industrial, and technological revolutions changed all that, and the resulting explosion of personal liberty has created a bewildering array of options, alternatives, choices, and decisions that our ancestors never faced. For the very first time, our happiness is in our hands. How are we to make these choices? In 1738, a Dutch polymath named Daniel Bernoulli claimed he had the answer. He suggested that the wisdom of any decision could be calculated by multiplying the probability that the decision will give us what we want by the utility of getting what we want. By utility, Bernoulli meant something like goodness or pleasure. The first part of Bernoulli's prescription is fairly easy to follow because in most circumstances, we can roughly estimate the odds that our choices will get us where we want to be. How likely is it that you'll be promoted to general manager if you take the job at IBM? How likely is it that you'll spend your weekends at the beach if you move to St. Petersburg? How likely is it that you'll have to sell your motorcycle if you marry Eloise? Calculating such odds is relatively straightforward stuff, which is why insurance companies get rich by doing little more than estimating the likelihood that your house will burn down, your car will be stolen, or your life will end early. With a little detective work, a pencil, and a good eraser, we can usually estimate, at least roughly, the probability that a choice will give us what we desire. The problem is that we can't easily estimate how we'll feel when we get it. Bernoulli's brilliance lay not in his mathematics, but in his psychology, in his realization that what we objectively get, wealth, is not the same as what we subjectively experience when we get it, utility. Wealth may be measured by counting dollars, but utility must be measured by counting how much goodness those dollars buy. Wealth doesn't matter. Utility does. We don't care about money or promotions or beach vacations per se. We care about the goodness or pleasure that these forms of wealth may or may not induce. Wise choices are those that maximize our pleasure, not our dollars. And if we're to have any hope of choosing wisely, then we must correctly anticipate how much pleasure those dollars will buy us. Bernoulli knew that it was much easier to predict how much wealth a choice might produce than how much utility a choice might produce, so he devised a simple conversion formula that he hoped would allow anyone to translate estimates of the former into estimates of the latter. He suggested that each successive dollar provides a little less pleasure than the one before it, and that a person can therefore calculate the pleasure they'll derive from a dollar simply by correcting for the number of dollars they already have. Bernoulli wrote, "The determination of the value of an item must not be based on its price, but rather on the utility it yields. The price of the item is dependent only on the thing itself and is equal for everyone. The utility, however, is dependent on the particular circumstances of the person making the estimate. Thus, there is no doubt that a gain of 1,000 ducats is more significant to a pauper than to a rich man, though both gain the same amount." Bernoulli correctly realized that people are sensitive to relative rather than absolute magnitudes, and his formula was meant to take this basic psychological truth into account. But he also knew that translating wealth into utility was not as simple as he'd made it out to be, and that there were other psychological truths that his formula ignored. Bernoulli wrote, "Although a poor man generally obtains more utility than does a rich man from an equal gain, it is nevertheless conceivable, for example, that a rich prisoner who possesses 2,000 ducats but needs 2,000 ducats more to repurchase his freedom will place a higher value on a gain of 2,000 ducats than does another man who has less money than he. Though innumerable examples of this kind may be constructed, they represent exceedingly rare exceptions." It was a good try. Bernoulli was right in thinking that the 100th dollar, or kiss, or donut, or romp in the meadow generally doesn't make us as happy as the first one did. But he was wrong in thinking that this was the only thing that distinguished wealth from utility, and hence the only thing one must correct for when predicting utility from wealth. As it turns out, the innumerable exceptions that Bernoulli swept under the rug are not exceedingly rare. There are many things other than the size of a person's bank account that influence how much utility they derive from the next dollar. For instance, people often value things more after they own them than before. They often value things more when they're imminent rather than distant. They're often hurt more by small losses than by large ones. They often imagine that the pain of losing something is greater than the pleasure of getting it, and so on, and on, and on, and on. The myriad phenomena with which this book has been concerned are just some of the not-so-rare exceptions that make Bernoulli's principle a beautiful, useless abstraction. Yes, we should make choices by multiplying probabilities and utilities, but how can we possibly do that if we can't estimate those utilities beforehand? The same objective circumstances give rise to a remarkably wide variety of subjective experiences, and thus it's very difficult to predict our subjective experiences from foreknowledge of our objective circumstances. The sad fact is that converting wealth to utility, that is, predicting how we'll feel from knowledge of what we'll get, isn't very much like converting meters to yards or German to Japanese. The simple, lawful relationships that bind numbers to numbers and words to words do not bind objective events to emotional experiences. So what's a chooser to do? Without a formula for predicting utility, we tend to do what only our species does. Imagine. Our brains have a unique structure that allows us to mentally transport ourselves into future circumstances and then ask ourselves how it feels to be there. Rather than calculating utilities with mathematical precision, we simply step into tomorrow's shoes and see how well they fit. Our ability to project ourselves forward in time and experience events before they happen enables us to learn from mistakes without making them and to evaluate actions without taking them. If nature has given us a greater gift, no one has named it. And yet, as impressive as it is, our ability to simulate future selves and future circumstances is by no means perfect. When we imagine future circumstances, we fill in details that won't really come to pass and leave out details that will. When we imagine future feelings, we find it impossible to ignore what we're feeling now and impossible to recognize how we'll think about the things that happen later. Daniel Bernoulli dreamed of a world in which a simple formula would allow us all to determine our futures with perspicacity and foresight. But foresight is a fragile talent that often leaves us squinting, straining to see what it would be like to have this, go there, or do that. There's no simple formula for finding happiness. But if our great big brains don't allow us to go sure-footedly into our futures, they at least allow us to understand what makes us stumble. This is Daniel Gilbert. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Stumbling on Happiness. This program was produced and directed by Charles Potter, executive producer Jacob Bronstein, text copyright 2006 by Daniel Gilbert, production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.